Web 2.0 Summit Program Chair John Battelle moderated a debate on net neutrality between Vint Cerf and Robert Pepper. Cerf is known as one of the fathers of the Internet. He is now a VP and Chief Internet Evangelist for Google. Pepper served in the Federal Communications Commission as an advisor to the last six chairmen. He now leads a team driving Cisco's global agenda for advanced technology policy. This podcast is brought to you by the Intel Software Network. Look for opportunity in using the web as a platform, using innovation to drive collective intelligence. The Intel Software Network did just that. Intel Software Network developer communities enable you to create and build innovative applications and solutions. Connect and share ideas today. Join the conversation in the Intel Software Network at www.intel.com/software. Here's the Web 2.0 Summit debate on net neutrality.
We didn't have to actually search too hard to find someone who was pro, net neutrality. But actually, it was funny how I found the fellow who was willing to argue the other side. I found him through Vint Cerf. So Vint has been very public and very vocal on behalf of both Google and his long affiliation with the web and the internet. But he said, the person who I'd like to be most on stage with is Bob Pepper, because Bob is very thoughtful. And we know each other, and we're pretty sure we won't throw chairs. And so with that, I'd like to bring Vint Cerf and Bob Pepper up. Come on, fellas. Vint Cerf, you guys can both sit here. Bob Pepper, have a seat. So let me just give a little background on these two guys. They're very...
Do you have to?
Yeah, I do, actually. Oh. I'm sorry. But you both are very accomplished, so I want to just put it out there. You're Vice President and Chief Internet Evangelist for Google. Before that, you served as a senior vice president for MCI,
That's right. An
upstart in the telco world, at least used to be an upstart in the telco world. So you understand that side of the world very well. You've lived in its underbelly. You're widely known as one of the fathers of the Internet.
Yes.
Are you going to graduate to grandfather at some point?
I hope not.
You're co-designer of TCP/IP protocols, architecture, and the architecture of the Internet. You were recently, last year, awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom for your work. Congratulations.
True.
And you're chairman of ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, which has to be the most aptly named organization in the world. The Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. Sort of Kafka-esque.
Sounds like something an engineer would have come up with.
Something an engineer would come up with as a name for a corporation. Now, Bob. Bob reminded me earlier in the green room that he does a lot more than argue about net neutrality, and that's certainly true. He leads a team driving Cisco's global agenda for advanced technology policy, and there's a lot going on around the world to discuss. IP-enabled services, broadband, wireless security joined Cisco in July of last year from the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, where Bob served to the last six chairmen of the FCC on policy development, focusing on issues cutting across industry and institutional boundaries. So I did a bunch of reading up, and I found some stuff that Bob had written recently, and this might get us started. You laid out a position on the issue by stating that net neutrality debate is laid out on what you called a false choice. New regulations will only stunt the growth of the networked economy. And I'm quoting from your article in Network World, pro-regulation net neutrality advocates have a new solution, but the problem they're trying to solve is theoretical. It does not exist. So let me start with a statement from both of you. let me let Bob start.
Oh.
Oh, well, mix in
it
that
up
case.
Right. All right. So, Bob, why don't you start, and then I'll let Vin
respond. All right, Robert, you can defend yourself now.
Okay, so actually, yesterday Barry gave me a great intro, right? He said, where are you going to find anybody who's against net neutrality? Well, part of the problem, right, is that it's not a well-defined term. So, I used to come to meetings like this, PC Forum and Vortex and your sessions, and I always had a guaranteed laugh line when I came from the FCC, right? I'd stand up and I'd say, hi, I'm from the government. I'm here to help you.
Right.
Right? Guaranteed laugh line, right? Because people understand that the government is not here to help. Not always. Right? And part of the problem is when you ask the government to come in and help you solve problems, it better be a real problem, because when government comes in to solve something, it doesn't always leave, and you have to be really careful what you ask for. So I can't use that laugh line anymore, right? But now that I'm no longer at the FCC, I actually can tell the truth.
Yeah, actually, you could say, hi, I'm from Cisco, and I'm here to help you, and you'd still get a good laugh.
Well.
All right, now settle down. Let it continue. So,
no, we just take out the order book, right? So the but the truth is, hi, I'm from Washington, the land of false choices. So let me tell you what the false choices are, right? About a year ago, there was a very senior CEO of a phone company who said, Google, Yahoo, who are these guys? Right? Why are they, doing so well, essentially, right? Right? I want to control, what they do. So we had this, and if I don't, we're going to have chaos. So there you have one side of it, right? If you don't control, you have chaos. Right? And then Vint and some of his buddies said, oh my God, if we allow the phone companies to manage these things, we're going to have tyranny. So we now have this dichotomous false choice, tyranny versus chaos. And of course, neither is true. So, and by the way, neither is acceptable. Neither tyranny nor chaos in the net is acceptable, because without networks that work, right, you can't develop the services that everybody in this room is trying to develop. You can't do, what Google does. So where are we? I mean, how do I think about this as a former regulator and understand the cost of regulation? 3 years ago, there was a group of high-tech companies called the High-Tech Broadband Coalition. And they submitted to, I was still at the FCC, and they brought to the FCC a platform, a set of principles. Very simple principles. First, consumers should have the right to connect their own devices to the net, right? And they should be interoperable. Very simple. Without that, you don't have the net. Second, within the terms of service that you buy, you have the right to be able to go out and get whatever content you want and use it, right? Third, you have the right to go out and get legal applications. I mean, you paid for them, same thing with content. And you run those applications. And fourth, which is probably the most important principle, is that consumers have sufficient information so that they know what they're buying and they can actually see what they bought. So if you want to translate that, those four principles, right? No blocking, no steering, no degradation, right? But it's also important to understand that you have to manage networks. Networks today are managed. Networks are always managed. You worked at MCI. Networks are managed. I mean, how many people here work for companies that have a virtual private network, a VPN, right? That's a managed network. So it's not black and white. It's not either or. These are core principles on which the internet has grown up and the internet has thrived, right? And those principles have to, remain, and they need to be strong going forward. If people violate those principles, they should be punished. And in fact, when I was at the FCC, we had a case in which we did that. There was a small phone company, rural phone company called Madison River, that was blocking the SIP ports because, they didn't want competition from Vonage. And very interesting, right? We got a complaint, staff called up, small phone company, got one of the senior executives, I think it was the CEO, and said, sir, this allegation that you're blocking SIP ports. What do you say about that? Damn straight I am. They're using my network and not paying for it. Right? And the answer was, sorry, you can't do that. And they stopped. And that was done very quickly. Right? So if there are problems, we think that with the right way to do this is on a case-by-case basis creating case law. What we don't think is necessary is the creation of a whole new regulatory regime that will inevitably lead to price regulation. It will lead to overreaching regulation of things that, while I was at the FCC for over a decade, we fought against. We did not want the internet to be subject to access charges. We did not want the internet to be subject to telephone regulation. We did not want the internet, especially in the peering and transit and backbone relationships, to be subject to rate regulation, right? And we succeeded in that. The extreme advocates, and Vint is not one of the extreme net neutrality regulatory advocates, but the extreme advocates are calling for a regulation of the internet that we've all fought against for at least 10 to 15 years.
No, Vint?
Well, let's see. First of all, I have a lot of respect for Bob. I worked with him off and on for all the time that I was at MCI. He was a permanent fixture and a voice of reason within the FCC. Let me remind everyone that the internet's success in part has been a consequence of its basic architecture, the layered structure, the distinction between the transmission layers, the switching layers, and the applications, and so on, and the fact that it was basically an end-to-end system. So people who wanted to try out new applications could do so because the intelligence was at the edges, not in the middle. You didn't have to get permission from a switching service provider or in order to try out new things. And that open, and I'm going to use the word non-discriminatory access before you levitate. My intent here is not necessarily to use a legal term, but one which basically says everyone was free to try things out and do things on the net without constraints in the interior. That has led to a cornucopia of applications. Web 2.0 and the discussions that are going on today are more evidence of that, and all of us, I think, including Bob, want to preserve that characteristic of the internet because it has led to so much innovation. If there were enough competition in the broadband world today, I would not be sitting here being an advocate for net neutrality or something along those lines. But there isn't a great deal of competition. The circumstances are that about 60% of the U.S. population has a choice of one of two broadband carriers. 30% have a choice of either one or the other, but not both, and 10% have no choice at all. If there were three or four or five choices, I would feel differently. When we were a dial-up environment, you did have almost unlimited choices. There were several thousand internet service providers, and it was easy to switch back and forth. You just changed the phone number that you dialed up to get to a different modem bank. But when it comes to broadband, the choices are very limited, and the switching is actually hard. I mean, if you wanted to go from a cable carrier to DSL, there's a truck roll involved and some other fairly complex stuff. Maybe your email gets changed and so on. The reason that I and my colleagues are still very concerned, and the reason there has been this debate, is that there is ample evidence that the current duopoly, and in some cases monopoly, is inclined to be anti-competitive. So as an example, attempts made to prevent by law the implementation of municipal networks on the grounds that somehow this is government competing with the private sector. The local exchange carriers have been quite visible in that effort. I find the reasoning there to be specious because the real facts are that if a municipality and its citizens decide they want to build a broadband facility for themselves and they tax themselves to do it with a bond, they will typically turn around and have it built by the private sector. It's just it may not be a local exchange carrier that builds it. So I don't think that this is really government interfering with the private sector at all. The big issue for me, and I think the one where Bob and I would probably agree, is that the consumers are at risk if we don't manage this process so that they are protected against anti-competitive behavior. And so this debate, in some sense, boils down to how do we do that? And the one side says, well, we should legislate it because we want it crystal clear and black and white that if you do the following things, you're in trouble and you will be punished or there will be consequences. And the other side says that's dangerous because getting the legislation right is difficult, and if you get it wrong, you get tangled up in snarls of court cases that don't ever sort themselves out. So just to make it clear, that at least in my view, is that we aren't trying to prevent the broadband carriers from charging more for increased amounts of capacity. So if you buy 1x data rate service and I buy 2x, I'd expect to pay more. Maybe not double, but some amount. And I also would appreciate being protected from denial of service attacks and other things that occur at the internet level. As for viruses, if I were getting email service, a value-added service from the same broadband provider, I would expect them to help filter those things out. But if I'm getting the email service from somebody else, I don't expect the broadband provider to be digging deep into my packets doing that for me. That's a higher layer application. I'd expect protection from my email service provider. I don't think it's okay for the broadband provider to take advantage of control over the physical layer to impose choices on consumers at higher layers. And if I understood what you said earlier, you would agree with that. So this boils down really to how do we protect consumers and maintain their choice? How do we protect providers and maintain their opportunity to innovate? And that's what we are struggling with, not the bumper sticker.
Right. And so, John, so one of the, I think, important issues that Vint raises is this, so how do you approach it? Ironically, and what I find to be very sad, is that there was legislation that passed the House, a slightly different version passed the Senate committee. It's all bottled up now. It's not going to happen. That would have addressed specifically these right. issues that Vint raises. Arguably, with the status with today's situation, there is a question about FCC authority. I think they have it. They think they have it. But, you know, somebody would challenge it in court, right? And so there's some level of ambiguity. The legislation would have clarified, the Senate bill more directly clarified, that the FCC explicitly has authority to go after, you know, bad actors that would violate these principles, because these principles would have been put into statute. The second thing, arguably, that there's a concern about is the speed of action, because it's an open-ended process. The Senate bill would have put a 120-day shot clock that said if the FCC gets a complaint, it had to decide and issue a decision within 120 days. You know, those two things in legislation would have gone a long way resolving this and giving the FCC teeth. And unfortunately, because of the regulatory advocates, the people who wanted more, that legislation is dead.
You sure that it's only dead because of that? Did Cisco back that legislation?
Yes.
Did the telcos back that legislation?
Yes.
Yeah, they did.
That's probably why the advocates were against it.
Well, no, but it's there were others that backed it as well. I mean, there are a whole slew of issues within the legislation, but if you look at all of the reports coming out of Washington in terms of the congressional committees, the statement by members, the statements by the staff, it was the net neutrality issue that essentially stopped that legislation.
Vin, did you back that legislation?
No, we didn't back that legislation, to be quite frank with you. And the reason we didn't is that we weren't persuaded by your argument that that would solve the problem. My concern, frankly, is that we've not seen success always in the past with FCC attempts to enforce protections that we're concerned about. There are really three elements here. One of them is the possibility of anti-competitive action, which would, generally speaking, fall to the Department of Justice. The question of consumer protection, which would fall to the Federal Trade Commission. And this question about whether internet service is an information service or a communication service, the shift from the Title II to Title I worried me anyway. And this is a place where I think some real dialogue would be useful. I always thought of the presence of internet in Title II as guaranteeing that there would be a kind of common carriage rule that assured that if you wanted to get access to the internet, you couldn't be denied access, nor would you be getting distorted access as a consequence of actions by the suppliers. You seem to, in our green room discussion, seem to think that we were better off with having things in Title I, where this is an information service in which there is no common carriage protection. Can you explain?
Well, first, the dial-up world telephone network access, I mean, yeah, that was common carriage. But if you moved up, you know, the layers, right, it was not. And that's what we kept outside of the telephone regulation. When Vince says Title II, that's telephone regulation in the law. Title I is general FCC authority. And that's where information services, where we defined the internet and internet access as an information service.
Okay, so here's a place where...
So, by the way, the other thing is cable access, right? Two-thirds of Americans get their broadband connection over cable. cable was never entitled to Understood. Begin with. So, I mean, it's a more complicated mix.
This is theorem 207. Everything is more complicated.
Sure.
But the thing that bugs me about moving over into the information service is that it removes any of the layered view of the system. And the internet is very has benefited from this layered structure, which says there really is a communications component. And that communication component is accessible to everybody who's just trying to move bits from point A to point B. It doesn't bind you necessarily to the same ISP.
But you know what we did? There was bits from point A to point B in the backbone, right? Yeah. That was never regulated. That was defined as an information service. That was never regulated as common carriage, thankfully. I mean, you just came back from Athens, where there was the Internet Governance Forum. There are advocates in other countries that want to regulate and have price regulation across the entire web. There are one of the arguments that we effectively used, right, when we dealt with these countries was to say, look, in the U.S., we don't regulate the Internet. We don't regulate these things as phone companies. And the reality is we've had all of these wonderful services develop on top of that. In Europe, right, they want to regulate video over the Internet as broadcast television.
Hey, let's be careful about which part of Europe we're talking about, because in the U.K., Ofcom is much more open.
No, but this is the European Commission.
This is going to okay. I don't know whether we're helping.
The point is that you once you begin to peel this regulatory onion, right, mm-hmm. there are all kinds of unintended consequences. And it comes down to benefit costs. We agree that the end-to-end principle is crucial. We agree that there shouldn't be any competitive behavior. Right? We agree that bad actors should be punished and punished quickly. The question, and I think the only difference that we have, is what's the best mechanism to do that with, right? And it boils right down to it. And, you know, on the one side, you have people who say, well, we can write detailed regulation that, you know, might be price regulation, because we've talked to some people up on Capitol Hill, say, well, regulate the Internet, why not? Right? That's not where I want to be, and that's not, I don't think, where you want to be. And so the issue is a strong case-by-case approach, right, and the benefit-cost, right, better, or is detailed telephone-type regulation better? And there are costs and benefits with each approach.
But first of all, I don't agree that this leads inevitably to price control. So there's a place where we absolutely don't have an agreement.
You've never been a regulator.
I'm sorry, I think you're wrong about that, given my current role at ICANN. I'm forced into regulatory-like problems anyway. So don't tell me I'm not a regulator.
You
or
heard
don't
it
know
here
about
first.
What regulation
Vint is a regulator.
However, I don't agree necessarily that price regulation is the outcome of all that. And I worry about case-by-case stuff, because I worry that it doesn't necessarily stick. And it takes a long time to figure out what the boundaries are of legitimate behavior. And the way you discover it is having case after case after case of abusive behavior, and you have to deal with them one by one. So I'm much more interested in having a framework established from the outset that clearly lays out what's valid behavior, what's legal behavior, and what is not, and what the punishments are.
Can I just ask pose a scenario here? I think that from the point of view of the folks in the audience, and certainly my limited point of view, is, you know, I'm paying $50, $60 a month to SBC/AT&T/whoever they recently bought to give me DSL. It works
They don't give it to you. You buy it from them.
I spend a fair amount of money to do that. I think that's my ticket, and I'm done. I don't need to think again about anything in terms. I am now allowed into this world, and there's no constraints on what I do as long as they're legal, right? The scenario that I think people are concerned about, and certainly that you've explained to me from Google's point of view, and that I think Barry Diller was referring to, is that after I pay that $50, the folks at AT&T/Verizon/Comcast want to go to Google and charge even more. To ensure that you can deliver the services to me that I think I'm getting for that $50 a month.
Doesn't this sound like the protection racket?
Well, it certainly does. And so, obviously, from my point of view, I think, my God, that sounds awful.
Right, so let me give you an example, though, of where, actually, this is sort of the double pay argument, which I don't think is what, you know, they're talking about. It certainly wouldn't be acceptable.
But let me give you a very concrete...
But if it's not acceptable, why not just canonize that?
No, but let me give you a specific example. So Bell South ran a beta trial last year of something called their turbosome, right? So for, you know, people who bought their 3-meg service, they could go to the turbosome. MovieLink was on there. HDNet was on there. It was essentially a video-on-demand service. 3-meg, that's what you buy. You go there, you get it. You were able to download it. No problem. You're able to see it streamed. Not a problem. If you were an entry-level Bell South DSL subscriber at 768 down, 128 up, you couldn't do that.
Right.
So they had a place on there that when you clicked on it, right, there was an arrangement that for the time of that movie, the 2 hours or whatever it was for the movie, you paid MovieLink to get the movie, which if you were a 3-meg customer, you would have done. If you're the 768 customer, right, you got to watch the movie. But MovieLink paid Bell South for the duration of the movie to boost you up to whatever speed was necessary for you to see the movie. It wasn't double payment because you were not a 3-meg subscriber.
I think everyone understands paying more for higher class service.
But it's a two-sided market, as the economists would describe it. In this instance, it wasn't the end user paying for 3-meg. It was for the duration of the movie, right? The content provider paying Bell South to boost you for that purpose.
Well, nothing would have been wrong on the other side of having the user charge for that, too.
Right. So they actually ran that as a trial. So for the duration of the movie, you would have to buy more, and it became nobody did it. It was too complicated.
What's complicated about click here to watch the movie? They didn't do it.
So you would ban 800 service because this is absolutely analogous to this two-sided market of 800 service. So it's not, Vint, it's not double paying. If I'm a $19.95 customer as opposed to the $50 customer, right, and I want to get content for somebody at the other end.
I don't think anyone's arguing that.
No, Vint just argued against that.
No. The big lie that I think we heard earlier, not from you, is that the application service providers were getting a free ride.
Of course they're not.
And the other thing that was not right
was when somebody said, Google, these guys don't invest. In 2005, your CapEx was $800 million. This year it's going to be way over a billion. You spend a lot of money on your data centers.
Okay, so point is made.
Yeah.
The ability to pay more, for increasing capacity on a temporary basis is a perfectly sensible thing. I don't have a problem with that, as long as the users know what's going on.
And it all goes back to user empowerment and user information and exactly.
Doesn't some of this come down to the folks at Verizon and Comcast and others looking around at the people in this room and saying, all these guys are being innovative and entrepreneurial and getting a bunch of money, and look at Google, and they're so wealthy and they're going to the moon. And they're doing it on our back, on our network, and we want to get in on some of this action. So we're sick of being plumbers. We want to do this other stuff. Look at Comcast. They've got a portal now. They're trying to be Yahoo. Now, if they're also got, you know, a significant percentage of the broadband access business, and they start to divert people toward Comcast services preferential treatment, you're saying is you're against that. But you prefer not to have it canonized, but rather argue it case by case.
Well,
I think all of us in the room are a little worried that those guys from Verizon and Comcast are a little better in Washington than we are.
Could we just make one observation that there is now in Korea a problem precisely of this kind? A Korean carrier has either blocked or interfered with the provision of video by competitors other than that particular broadband carrier's video offerings. That's an example.
That would be a violation of the principles, and that should be dealt with through an adjudication and a process that, you know.
But shouldn't that just be against the law?
But what is it that's? What do you mean by the first? The short answer is yes, and it would be on a case by case basis.
Uh-huh.
When you have competition authorities that deal with anti-competitive behavior, right? You want them to have swift enforcement capability to say, this is not permissible, stop it, and we're going to fine you or whatever. The fact is, that is how competition law works.
Right.
But you can't in competition law come up with every conceivable scenario, every conceivable theoretical way of acting anti-competitively. You have a process that looks at that and you enforce it. So it really does come down to this question of, do you enshrine detailed regulation that, you know, nobody has been able to tell me when I've asked. Light regulatory touch sounds great.
But what it's an oxymoron.
But let's actually see what it means and how does it work. And how does that, you know, with quality service, trade-offs, how does that get you to the point where you're not regulating prices and you're not regulating things that you don't want to regulate? Let's prevent and punish bad behavior and have the tools to do that. Let's put in the law the kind, you know, the high-tech broadband coalition principles, right, which could be done. I really fear that this was the last year that we would have a chance to do that, because this year, in the dynamic in Washington, the Bells had a reason to push legislation, and that was to get cable franchising relief.
Right?
They're not going to have
this.
We
can't go into cable franchising relief.
No,
we're running out of time.
All right.
But I do want to give Vin a chance to sort of do a summary or his last statement, because I let you open.
Well, thank you. I appreciate
that. Because we're running out of time.
First of all, thank you for letting both of us have this discussion. I think that what it boils down to is focusing on a constructive effort, which I think you and I both would like to see happen, and that is focused attention on protecting consumers from abusive behavior by monopolies or duopolies that are interfering with the kind of innovation that the Web 2.0 participants are engaged in right now. Whether we achieve this through regulatory mechanisms or others, I think, is part of the debate. But that we want to achieve that objective, I think, is essential and agreeable.
Thank you both very much for coming, and I'm sure these folks will have lots to talk to you about at the break. So please join me in thanking you.
Thanks, man.
Vint Cerf and Robert Pepper debating net neutrality at the Web 2.0 Summit 2006. This podcast is brought to you by the Intel Software Network. Jumpstart your development of innovative applications with developer tools and resources from the Intel Software Network. Innovative applications begin with you. Use the Intel Software Network to find tools and resources that help you develop innovative applications. Find resources and best practices in our software developer communities. Connect with fellow developers to share ideas and learn best practices. Join the conversation in the Intel Software Network at www.intel.com/software.